Hello, I'm Claire Wright, Professor of Public Engagement at La Trobe University. Welcome to Literary La Trobe, a podcast showcasing the writing and research of La Trobe University's staff, students, alumni, and adjuncts. The recording you're about to hear is from the 2024 Bendigo Writers Festival. I was fortunate to be the co-curator of the Bendigo Writers Festival in 2024, programming a suite of sessions under the La Trobe Presents banner. The festival took place on the second weekend of August on the unceded country of the Dja-Dja-Wurrung and Tungurung peoples of the Kulin Nation. In this event, three historians, Dr. Mark Dappin, Professor Anna Clark, and Dr. Shannon Palmer, explore approaching Australian history through a revisionist or decolonising lens with host, La Trobe's adjunct, Professor Stuart Kells. Closing gala. Please note, some of these live events may contain strong language. I hope you enjoy.
Thanks for coming. Absolute pleasure to be here with you talking about history at the Bendigo Writers' Fest. As you know, the festival takes place on the country of the Dja-Dja-Wurrung and Tungurung people, and we acknowledge the traditional owners of these lands and their living culture and the unique role they play in the life of the region. Really pleased to be here with this very distinguished panel who represent really an important and new current in writing about Australia and writing about Australian history and even defining Australian history. So it's a pretty special gathering. And I think we probably owe Claire Wright a bit of a debt in bringing this panel together. So three distinguished authors and historians. Professor Anna Clark has written several influential books about Australian history, including Making Australian History, and with the great Stuart McIntyre, the late great Stuart McIntyre, The History Wars, which won the New South Wales Premier's Prize and the Queensland Premier's Prize for History. Dr. Shannon Palmer wrote Unmaking Angus Downs, a fellow author at Melbourne University Publishing, for which she received the 2024 Ernest Scott Prize and the 2023 Prime Minister's Literary Award for Australian History, which is as good as it gets. And finally, Dr. Mark Dappin, the author of Lest, a book of Australian war myths. Mark has also written several other books and a lot of shorter pieces, and he edited the Penguin Book of Australian War Writing. So would you please join me in welcoming the panellists? I'm going to kick off just by a few sort of framing comments about... I suggested that this is sort of a new cohort of writers in Australian history. And, you know, what defines that cohort? What are some of the threads in that cohort? And I think if you look at these three books that we're talking about, particularly today, Unmaking Angus Downs, Making Australian History, and Lest, there's a few threads. One of them is fearlessness. There's an incredible fearlessness, and I think Mark's probably the best exemplar of that, leading with his chin in busting some sacred myths about Australian military history. But they're fearless books. They're myth-busting counter-histories as much as they're history books. They're engagingly written, very not pompous. Australian history was quite pompous for a long time and very male, very sort of colonial, very pompous, right? And this is the opposite of that. Rigorous, and I think a lot of Australian history was made up, it's fair to say, cut to the chase. People made up stories and called it Australian history. This is the opposite of that. This is true and rigorous and based on evidence and engaging with that and engaging with how people have told stories that aren't true about history as well. It's inclusive history, it's accessible history, and it reflects Australia today rather than some sort of wacky idea about what Australia is or what Australia should be. So that's a bit of a frame for our conversation about what these books do and what this new cohort of historians do. So I'm going to start with a big question to Anna, and full apologies for this. But in defining Australian history, what is Australian history? what is Australia? What is a nation? And what is history?
That's really unfair, Stuart. All worthwhile and important questions. What do you want me to answer first?
Well, who is Australian history for?
Yeah, that's a good question. Okay. I mean, Australian history, there are various elements about what is Australian history. There's Australian history, the past, what happened, but there's also the practice of Australian history and the stories that we tell about ourselves. So we could say that Australian history is the relationship between what happened and what didn't happen and those interpretations of that past, I would argue. But if we think about Australian history, I guess I like to think about it perhaps like a map, so that if we think of the sort of topography of Australian history, at any one time the borders of the map might include what is and what isn't Australian history. So we might imagine a map where Aboriginal oral histories, for example, fell outside the borders of what is history, but now they're well and truly within the borders of what is history. So that map of Australian, the question, what is Australian history, the answer to that changes over time is what I'm getting at. And I think that's, as people who are interested in Australian history and telling the stories of Australian history, it's also really important to be aware that Australian history, the discipline and the practice, has changed over time, and sort of to be attentive to that changing nature of historical interpretation and historical practice.
And the Indigenous aspect of that's really important. I see all the time, still today, books of local history, regional history. They might be 200 pages, and there'll be a page or perhaps a chapter about Indigenous history, and then the rest is our history, and it's they did this, they did that, and it's very othering about Indigenous people, and it's not reflective of the continuity of Indigenous culture and Indigenous ownership.
It parks Indigenous history into pre-history, as if it's not real history, but it also excludes it from those enduring and, you know, really vital discussions about Australian history as well. So it sort of, in terms of temporality or the chronology of Australian history, it puts it prior to the beginning of Australian history, which is obviously a huge disservice. But it also means that any kind of discussion about what is history is relegated, because it can't occur within the kind of framing of, you know, so-called real history.
Shannon, the kind of history that I've talked about, that's rigorous, that's inclusive, that's true, my sense is that it's fundamentally anti-racist and anti-colonial. And I really sort of felt that when I was reading your book. It's true to the past, it's true to the present. It is unflinching in how it talks about difficult subjects. It talks about complex things from multiple perspectives. It's not sort of, you know, reductive or over-summarising. And I think in some other countries, history doesn't function necessarily in the same way, that it doesn't function in an anti-colonial or an anti-racist way. Can you speak a bit more about that, and also about the aspect of storytelling and a local focus, sort of the idea of writing history locally, but then globally or at least nationally?
Okay, so first one.
It's a few different ideas there, I'm sorry.
And sort of an idea of an anti-colonial history. I mean, it really sort of touches a lot on what Anna was just talking about. I mean, Unmaking Angus Downs emerged out of really big questions that I had about the discipline of history and the way in which we've practiced it in Australia. As a mature age student at university studying history, I was really troubled and challenged by a lot of what I was learning in my late 20s that I hadn't encountered growing up in primary school or in secondary school. And I really began to think deeply about what is it about the discipline of history that has perhaps created this silence and also white noise that dominated so much of our history writing in the 19th and 20th century. It is sort of an epistemological question about knowledge. It is a particular way of producing knowledge, and Anna and Mark's books both sort of touch on this idea that it is produced by historians. We are curators, and it's a particular way of you know, of curating the past. And historians, you know, the cornerstone of the historian's craft is the documentary archive, a very particular way of thinking about time. And so for myself, I wanted to explore what it could mean. First of all, you know, how can I go about engaging critically with this silence and this white noise? How, as a historian, might I practice, conceptualise, research and write history that not just takes into account First Nations perspectives but is also shaped by them? And so for me, it was very much, you know, what happens when the historian turns to country and the landscape as an archive and takes seriously and to heart embodied forms of knowledge and memory? And through engaging with those sort of questions in my work, I moved to Central Australia, I bought a Land Cruiser, I spent 5 years out on country recording oral histories about Angus Down Station in Pitjantjatjara with the two elders that I worked really closely with, Chucky Pumpjack and Sandra Armstrong. And so in that process, being immersed in country and in language, you know, I came to understand very quickly Angus Downs is a pastoral station, and there's, you know, it's one of the most powerful symbols of national sort of storytelling and myth-making here in Australia, I think. Pastoralists and pioneers have been really dominant figures in the myth-making here. And I began to learn sort of through this process of immersion that Angus Downs, the story of this place, has very little to do with pastoralism. There was so much more to this place than that colonial practice. And so in really, again, taking that seriously, I wasn't sort of really aware of it at the time, but I think in really taking that to heart, I did find that the more immersed I became in that practice, in language, the very cornerstone of the historian's craft, the archive, became othered in the process. So I began to see things in the archive that I would have missed. And so it was that sort of process, I think, that then led to what became sort of an anti-colonial sort of historical practice that...
Oh, I was just going to jump in and say, your question is a really interesting one because it I don't think history has always been anti-racist. And historians have not always been attempting decolonisation, and many still don't. And so it really, I think Shannon's book is a very powerful example of how historical practice changes over time, and arguably for the first 150, 200 years of Australian history or colonial history, as it was practiced, was absolutely about colonisation. Yep. And racism and crafting whose stories mattered and whose heritage mattered. And historians, you know, were absolutely complicit in that project. So I recommend everyone buy Shannon's book, actually, because it really teases out the threads of how those of us who practice history and are worried about or thinking about our complicity in, you know, Australian history's complicity in the colonial project, how we might continue to practice history in a way that builds something and crafts new stories and new ways of understanding the continent on which we live and its past.
There's something in common, I think, between all three books, is that they are talking about big themes, but they're also very personal, and there's a localised element. In Shannon's case, the book has a gem-like quality where it has this real focus on the local and the personal, but it's actually telling the biggest stories about Central Australia, so about colonialism, about resilience, about economic development and storytelling and history-making. It is, in some ways, a history of Central Australia, but through that, you know, that narrower and more specific lens of a particular pastoral enterprise. But we've talked about this before. The way I think about it is a series of nested stories, and they're big stories. It's a really big story that you tell, but through that wonderful frame.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think there's a lot of value in the local. When we sort of try and tell big sweeping stories, grand narratives, you know, we sort of... You have the tendency to miss so much of the complexity and the nuance, and it's so much an issue and so much the myth-making that has sort of taken place in this country. And I mean, and I think local sort of or regional history is also sort of seen a bit as less than, or you know, but this is a vast continent with incredible ecological, environmental diversity that has created and shaped all different kinds of processes, culturally incredibly diverse as well. And so there's a lot of value and a lot to be learned from looking at the local. We can tell really big stories by going really closely and looking at a particular place and learning about that place from the people who actually lived there.
Fantastic. Mark's book also has a strongly personal element and blends the local and the global. I love Mark's book. Lots of people don't love Mark's book.
You keep saying this.
One of the reasons why. I'm going somewhere with this. One of the things that Mark has done with this book is go in and sort of say, well, a lot of sacred myths about Australia's military history aren't true. They're not founded on fact. They didn't happen. But the way that Mark does that, he doesn't sort of dance around and do it gently. He goes straight for it and leads with his chin in a really good way, in a way that I like and I respect. And it's similar to what I did with my Shakespeare book, which managed to annoy all of one side of the Shakespeare debate and all of the other side of the Shakespeare debate. And so Mark has done that in a pretty fraught sort of area of military history, whereas mine was a bit of a safe zone. Yours is much less safe, but it's okay. So there's lots of questions I have about that. One's about courage, but also you know, it's a question of tone and a question of sort of how do you engage with this sacred material in a way that's serious but also engaging. And the thing that struck me about your book is it does have that kind of very, it's not quite a jokey sort of tone, but it's a really kind of colourful, gonzo-ish sort of tone at times, but also very serious and very well-founded. So do you get what I'm saying? That there's an interesting sort of dimension of your storytelling around tone and about style. Do you want to speak a bit to that? But also the fact that you led with your chin in the most sacred space in Australian history.
Yeah, until I started discussing this with Stuart, I thought everybody loved me and everyone loved my books. But quite taken aback by this sudden realisation. I certainly didn't set out to annoy anybody, really. Well, two people, actually, but... All right, I admit. one of them was, as you're aware. I actually wanted to write this book that everybody would like about the Emu Wars. That's where it began. I did a six-part series for Radio National about myths of military history, more gently, I suppose, interrogating myths of military history and interviewing historians who knew more than me, which is all historians, about even Claire, about military history. Claire did an episode with me. And while I was doing that, my son said to me, is it true that Australia once fought a war against emus? And I go, no, it's rubbish. You know, with the absolute confidence of the absolutely ignorant. I went, no, it's rubbish, mate, rubbish. Because that's how I talk to my children. Then I found out that it wasn't rubbish, that in fact there had been a sort of militarised wildlife management program that even at the time was known as the Emu War. So I thought I'd write a book about that. But my publisher said, no one would be interested. By the way, there's two movies about the Emu War now. Good one, Ben, yeah. He said, why don't you write a broader one based on myths and military history and what you did on Radio National. So, yeah, I didn't set out to lead with my chin and annoy everybody, but I accept I may have done so. With tone... So I guess I did grow up, supposedly, in the late 70s, in the punk era, and I've always had that kind of idea that you must demystify what you are doing, you must show process, you must not only express your conclusions, but talk about every step on the way to that conclusion. It's a kind of weird sort of DIY indie, although I hate that word, ethos. So in this book, and I didn't want to make it seem like I was... although I did want to write a book of liberal scholarship, I really did, sort of classic liberal scholarship. I didn't want to make out like I was somehow unbiased or I wasn't an individual that had their own ideas and prejudices and life experience that was feeding into the way that I dealt with this material. And similarly, I didn't want to make it appear that I didn't think it was funny, not only my own mistakes but other people's errors. So I tried to write history with a kind of underlying memoir and this kind of weird DIY ethos, and it comes out a bit gonzo. Again, I'm always surprised when people say that. I would never have thought anything I had done was gonzo, but I am taught in universities as a gonzo journalist. Just in case people wondering if I'm taught in universities, because yeah, I am here. Yeah. Who'd have thought? can I answer more of your question?
Maybe we'll come back. Is that okay? Yeah. Because I think what you're talking about is a common factor in all three books to different degrees, right? It's personal and objective. It's engaging and has that myth-busting element, has that kind of, edge to it. And, books with edge, they're good books, right? They're not bland. They're not boringly safe. And that's a really important hook for the reader, right? In my writing, I try to make sure that there are serotonin hits at regular stages for the reader, whether they're jokes or whether they're revelations or whether they're some sort of scandal or whatever, and it keeps the reader engaged as a piece of writing as well as a piece of history. So I think all three books do that in different ways, that they engage the reader, they delight the reader, and they have a bit of edge to it. Would you agree that that's it's almost like a generational change? I really like the fact that you're anchoring it into the punk movement and the sort of 70s and 80s, because we're in different ways, we're all sort of products of that, and maybe the generation after that as well. I think that's a really interesting insight. The way we think about history is different. So I guess a question for Anna and for Shannon: are we at a sort of a generational change moment in the practice of Australian history, or has it already happened? And is that sort of edge an element? Is that a defining element that you think is present?
I think absolutely. I mean, I was really struck by the way that you described it as DIY punk ethic. I think that's really great. I mean, and Anna, you touched on it in your book as well, about us sort of being in a particular moment where, historians as disciplinary actors are having to be more transparent about how it is we come to know what we know. And so even though I am in the narrative, really sort of, it's sort of really important that I'm not inserting myself in the narrative. It's, it's not about me, and it's not about me being the knower or the expert on this subject. It's really about being accountable and transparent and saying to the reader, this is how I came to know this story of this place. I think we are in a particular moment where the historian as sort of all-knowing, omnipotent sort of narrator, it just doesn't hold. And we do need to be transparent about how it is that we come to know what it is that we know.
Yeah, I like your use of the word transparent there, because when you said we were objective, I feel like a lot of what I've been writing about in the book is a kind of critique of so-called objectivity and all-knowingness. When I grew up in the 80s, I was petrified of punks. I thought they were really scary. but I like that observation of being popular and accessible and saying things. I felt like when I was writing this book, the ideas were so big, I felt like I was just trying to push around shipping containers, and I just felt the labour of that. So in order for those ideas to make sense, I did try to write them as simply as possible, just for my own. So when you're trying to structure, you make each sentence short and understandable, and that was the only way I could kind of wade through what I felt were the big ideas. But absolutely, in terms of putting myself in the text, it wasn't to be an actor, it was to show the point I was making, that historians, history isn't just presented by all-knowing know-it-alls. It's presented by people who have contexts and questions pertinent to their own generation, which change over time. And so I wanted to say, hey, I'm just one of them too, and this is the latest one. But people before me have changed and had differing opinions about the past, and it will go on into the future.
So there's a rigour there, which is about being transparent, sometimes about subjectivity rather than objectivity.
And authenticity, I suppose, and not pretending that your book might be the only answer, but it's given in good faith as an honest and genuine contribution to a process that's been going on for a long time.
So you and Shannon have peers and contemporaries in academia who are writing in a very different mode, and there's that whole discourse around what academia does to writers and what academia does to writing and to the accessibility of writing. You know what I mean? Like there's
Absolutely.
Modes of writing that are quite sort of distancing and forbidding and narrowing in what people actually read. But obviously these books are intended for a mass audience, a large audience, and you have the pleasure of, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, even millions of people reading your words, which
yeah,
a lot of academics...
absolutely. Millions, easily.
Or
yeah.
Potentially millions. Well, I had this conversation with someone the other day who wrote a book about Australia and Indonesia in a really very grounded and very evidence-based way. And I said to him, well, in 200 years, when someone wants to know about this particular moment and this particular question of Australia and Indonesia, this is the thing they're going to look at. Right. So you're writing, you're laying down tracks for people in 200 years and 400 years and beyond. Hopefully there will be things called reading and there will be things called people in 400 years. So do you have a sense of how these things fit into academia and what do your peers think about you writing in this mode? Has the world moved on where you don't get punished for writing for a popular audience?
I've never really invested too much energy in those sort of questions, you know. I mean, actually do think that academics have a responsibility. They're publicly funded institutions.
Took the words right out of my mouth, Shannon.
Academics have a responsibility to communicate with people, the public, outside of those institutions. And one of the things, most frustrating things I found about being in the academy was that it was just a lot of people talking to themselves and a small group of people. So, you know, for me to have my book sort of read widely by the public, that is the greatest thing that I could ask for. You know, as a writer, it's a great gift when people read and respond to your words. So as many people, I'm really just not even bothered by anyone who might think that I've compromised something in some way. Because for myself and this project as well, I was collaborating with Anangal, Pit and the other speaking people who, you know, English wasn't their first language. Chuki, who I worked really closely with, his English was incredibly limited. And so, you know, it was a huge weight that I felt when writing that. For me, it was always, you know, how do I sort of tell this story in a way that is meaningful and accessible to as many people as possible? Because that was a driving force for them. Working with me, recording these stories in language, a big part of that motivation was to having that recorded for their children, their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren, but they were also very acutely aware that I was going to write a book that white fellas might end up reading. And that was very, very important to them as well. And so for me, it was, you know, I really had that sort of carried that responsibility of I need to get this book done and for it to reach as many people as possible. And, you know, there are definitely limitations with that. You know, it was a PhD thesis to begin with. There are compromises. But I do think that both Chuki and Sandra, although they have passed away now, would be really proud. I'm in close contact with their grandchildren and they've all got copies of the book and are constantly asking for new copies of the book and it gets passed around. And so, yeah, it has many different kinds of lives, I think.
Brilliant. Well, we've succeeded in agitating the audience. I'm seeing a whole series of questions coming through, some of them polite. We'll segue to those in a minute. As a sort of a closing off question for this part of the session, Mark myth is really important in your book and in the space that you're engaging with. How does myth function, or how do you think myth functions in the way that people think about military history and the sort of that sacredness of some of these stories? Myth is functional, right? And you're puncturing myth. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, my perspective on myth changed a lot as I was writing the book. But what I came to believe in the end, which I don't suppose is particularly profound, I say in a book, I suspect everybody but me knew this, is people tell stories of things that happen physically that read simply to express how they felt emotionally, mentally. So to come to the point which I suppose has got me the most flack, when I say that Vietnam veterans returning by air to Sydney Airport did not and could not possibly have faced demonstrations at midnight from spitting protesters, that doesn't mean that that story doesn't have emotional value. It doesn't mean that they didn't feel as though they were victimised by protesters in the dead of night upon their return, that people didn't want them to come home. So you can accept all of that as a feeling without accepting the impossible idea that hundreds of demonstrators somehow assembled at Sydney Airport when soldiers returned to a guard of military police. They had to pick up their pay. You know, it's a high security environment anyway. So you can, you can accept the emotional truth of it while at the same time rejecting the historical truth.
Can I also add that I think the important thing about myths is that they don't just relate to stuff that happened in the past, they actually reflect what people want to feel now.
Yes.
And in the moment, which explains why the Anzac legend changes its tempo over time and its meaning in the 1920s when it's being contested and people are coming back and are embittered with war, or in the 1960s during the Vietnam War, is very different from in the 1990s. When it becomes a kind of a real sort of really important political crucible, if you like.
Yes, you're
and,
right,
and
yeah.
Myth-making, like all forms of history-making, is as much about the people now asking questions of the past as it is about the past itself.
Very much, yeah. I mean, the thing that most surprised me about research was the history of Anzac Day. Like, I had no idea that in the first Anzac Day, people dressed up as cavemen and chased around people dressed up as dinosaurs. Like, this has been largely forgotten. Who knows why? There were regular kind of fancy dress contests on Anzac Day right from 1915 to 1929 was the last one I could find. That there was a stage tram crash as an entertainment at the first Anzac Day. That there were things that I don't even think we've got the vocabulary to talk about now. Minstrels in blackface, minstrels, throughout Anzac Day parades again, right, I'm not even sure when that ended, but in Australia and in the very first Anzac Day in France with Monash's troops, they were entertained by, you know, hilariously dressed men in blackface. So when people talk about returning to Anzac traditions, they're recently invented traditions. You know, you want to go back into blackface and chase the people dressed as dinosaurs around, like Chris Flynn would be a good one to chase around dressed as a dinosaur. You know, that's... He's written a book from a point of view of a dinosaur. you know, those are real traditions that nobody is calling for the return of. We invent traditions that we, that, as you say, suit the questions we're asking today, suit the way we feel today.
Mark, you touched on, in the preamble when we were speaking earlier, you touched on a dimension of the space you're writing in where people are making up stories about these myths, but they're also making up stories about themselves, about their military service, or the fact that they were eligible for being called up when they weren't, or...
What I was saying was... one of the things that really got me thinking about this whole question was, when I came here, when I first came to Australia in 89 and people talked about the Vietnam War, there's this idea that the peace movement was hegemonic. That, you know, everybody was in the peace movement. Nobody like supported the Vietnam War. And so one of the chapters in my book is about the pro-war movement, about which you hear nothing. Like, the right has virtually written itself, the activist right, has virtually written itself out of the history of the Vietnam War, and I'm still not entirely sure why. But this guy, a former Maoist called Dave Nadell, said to me, I reckon there's as many people who lie about having been in the peace movement as there are fake Vietnam veterans, you know, people who lie that they were in Vietnam. And there's so many points to make about this, but some of the stories about some of the better known stories about atrocities committed by supposedly committed by Australian soldiers in the Vietnam War, they were fake veterans telling those stories. They're not real stories. They weren't real veterans. It's oral history nonsense. And that's the danger, I think, of using anonymous sources in oral history, which is something I come back and back to. So you got people pretending to be in the peace movement, you got people pretending to have been Vietnam veterans. But the other day, like, I was just astonished. I don't know if anyone saw it, but there was a piece in The Australian a few months back. John Singleton, the ad man, took out a full-page piece which was headed something like "An Apology to Ben Robert Smith by a Coward." And he's saying, you know, we don't, basically the thrust of it was, we don't understand, we who have not gone to war do not understand what happens in the fog of war, we cannot judge you for what you did, blah, blah, blah. And he outs himself as a coward who dodged the draft, and but he didn't dodge the draft. John Singleton's not eligible for the draft. John Singleton is like 3 years too old to have gone to Vietnam. Like, what does this mean? Like, you've got fake Vietnam veterans, you've got fake peace campaigners, and now you've got fake cowards. What are they trying to do to me? I'm trying to write history here, you know?
Shannon was going to answer a question we had from the floor, if that's okay.
Okay, I will begin by saying it's not a naive question. But the question was, what's the difference between Shannon's approach and, say, Deborah Rose Byrd's? Who was not a historian, and how long was Shannon's relationship with the community she worked with, and is it ongoing? So I'll begin by saying Deborah Byrd Rose is a scholar whose work I drew on heavily while I was researching and writing this book, and I would probably say probably more than any other scholar engaged with her entire body of work. Really, really instrumental in shaping my approach to working with Chucky and Sandra. Place in particular, place is sort of crucial in the history that I write, and I sort of use it quite deliberately as a way of sort of destabilising this sort of focus on time or archives. Place is the lens, a conceptual lens in the book, which is a sort of a deliberate mode at trying to be sort of an anti-colonial sort of approach, I suppose, and very much indebted to Deborah Byrd Rose in the development of that approach. In terms of our methodologies, very similar, I would say, in terms of field work, much more common. Deborah Byrd Rose is an anthropologist, so really sort of commonplace in that discipline, not so much in history. But in terms of that sort of fieldwork approach, going and living with, working with the community over extended period of time, very sort of similar in approaches. But she was an anthropologist and myself as a historian, so it's sort of then taking different sort of approaches with what came out of that process. I mean, and in some ways I think, you know, Deborah Byrd Rose had particular questions that sort of drove her practice, whereas I was sort of more interested to see what would emerge out of a process. And so I really went in with very, like, Chucky and Sandra really did actually dictate the literal places that we would go to and the stories that they would tell. I had no idea where this was all going when it began, and I was really being sort of steered by them. And so we recorded oral. The question of sort of how long was the relationship is, it sort of, you know, we recorded, physically sort of travelled out onto country and recorded oral histories over a period of about 4 years. but the relationships continued after that. Even though the research period had wound up, we were still very much in each other's lives and saw each other. Sadly, Chucky passed away in 2015. When I first started working with him, he was approximately sort of between 83 and 85 is what we could work out. So really late in his life. And so he passed away not long after we finished recording together. And him, you know, being very aware, was very aware that he was coming to the end of his life, and it was a huge catalyst for working with me as well. Sandra passed away, sadly, in 2020, but we kept in touch throughout. And I'm still in regular contact with their grandchildren. Like most weeks, I will speak to them, and that will, you know, and that's a sort of a key part of that sort of, you know, the approach. I sort of went into it sort of knowing that, you know, I wasn't, definitely didn't want to fly in, fly out. You just sort of go in and take and then go off and write a PhD and write a book and that's it. I did go into this thinking that, you know, I was establishing these relationships and I wanted them to be genuine, and understanding that that is ongoing.
Oh, I was just going to say, the thing I really was struck with your book is not just the relationship to the people but also to the place itself. And it's very interesting, I think, in Australian history, over much of Australian history, place is something that history happens on. You know, stories happen on, people act on, but place is an agent, a character in your book, and the sort of animate sense of place really comes through so strongly. It's not just, you know, a diorama or a frieze. It's filled with, it's kind of agentic.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that's really shaped by working closely with Chucky and Sandra as well, because for someone, you know, I sort of realised really early on that in recording stories with Chucky and Sandra, I was always being taken on a journey. There were these really long stories that were punctuated by place names. And so he was always moving through country. And so it's, you know, I sort of realised early on, oh, history, you know, doesn't happen at a particular time for Anango and for Chucky and Sandra. It happens here and there and in places. Place, you know, and so it was a sort of key part of me grappling with, you know, that sort of engagement with a worldview that was really different to my own, whereby meaning, all meaning, is embedded in place.
And we as historians aren't necessarily trained to deal with place as a character in our histories, I think. It's something that, you know, I didn't learn it in History 101, or
it
can only come by being in those places and listening to people who can speak for place.
And it was definitely something that I learned kind of on the fly as well.
Three wonderful books, and I can't commend them enough. We've almost exhausted the questions on the text messages, but we still can take questions from the room. One of the questions was if I personally could introduce myself as well, because I don't think I did that before. For people who are non-Bendigo and non-Latrobe people is the way that the questioner framed it. And so I can use that as a bit of an excuse to plug a few of my books very quickly while people are thinking about the next question, if that's okay. I write a lot, and I write across a whole bunch of different areas. I have several institutional histories brewing or published. One of the most important, with Claire here, is the history of La Trobe University, which is due to come out in 2027 for the 60th anniversary, founded in 1967. I've recently written a history of the Mildura region. One of my most important La Trobe connected books was a history of the big four accounting firms, right? And that came out before all of the PwC stuff that you all know. So that came out in 2018, but foreshadowed and provided the frame for a lot of what's followed around the big four accounting firms and the disaster of that. And recently with Melbourne University, I've published a book on finance and banking, which does the same thing. So in 5 years' time, you will all be looking back on that book that came out this year and say, oh, well, I actually warned you about money and banking and finance and things. So you should have a look at it. It's a very strangely framed book. It's called Alice. No one knows why it's called Alice. But there's a lot going on in that book. And it's essentially it'll be for banking, what the Big Four book was for the Big Four in 2018. So questions from the room, please. Oh, sorry. We've got two. Just popped. There you go. Does writing history over time become our own making of oral myths? We're trying not to do that, I think, is part of the answer.
I don't know if they become oral myths because they... but, you know, if you think of the process of history making as an ongoing conversation or a process, then it's iterative and it's layer upon layer upon layer, like oral histories are, for sure. And they're inherited, they're passed on, and things are added to them, but also things are forgotten in that process of curation. What are you going to put up in your art gallery of history? You take stuff off the wall and put it up. It's always a process of editing. And if there's one thing I really wanted to convey in that book is that history making is editing. And different historians will choose what to put in and what to put out, what to leave out. Different generations of historians will do that. The answers that we come up with that go into our books are really dependent on the questions we ask. And it's quite hard to know what questions will be asked in 50 years. So in terms of where we might be and where history, the process of history making might be, I think might be another way of thinking about that question is where does it go, and who will be considered a historian, and who will be, and what will be considered history?
And part of the answer is what you touched on before around transparency, making the subjective transparent, making the judgments that you're applying, making them transparent as well. Shannon's got a question.
There's a few that have come through, so I'll answer this one.
Sure.
As quickly as I can, someone's asked about, can I talk about the way that Chucky described that this, I'm assuming it's the way that Chucky's sort of story of the end of Angus Downs, which is a really sort of interesting example of the complexities of writing histories of colonial encounter, and sort of touches on the question of what is truth, or what is truthful. And so when I asked Chucky why Arnungal left Angus Downs, Chucky told me it was because Arthur Little, a station owner, died. And that when Arthur Little died, everything finished up and they all had to go. And he specifically said if he hadn't died, we would still be there now. And I didn't think much of it at the time. It was just one of sort of many stories that we recorded together. And then when I sort of came to sort of examine, dig deep into why Angus Downs, the station, ended. Arthur Little, the Little family, was still running that station into the 1990s, and Chucky and the other Arnungal left in the late 70s, and they were living in a Mumpa community by 1980. So I was confronted with this big conundrum, like how do I sort of make sense of this story? When I asked Sandra the question, Sandra told a very sort of faithful story, and it's actually a really sort of complex story because there were many different factors. Equal wages were introduced on pastoral stations, although no one was paid wages really in Central Australia, so it didn't have that great of an impact. But welfare benefits started being paid directly to Aboriginal people, which Chucky referred to as sit-down times, the start of sit-down times. And he said that when sit-down times, like Arthur Little died, sit-down times started, and then that's where his storytelling ended. And so in the last part of the book, I really sort of grapple with why Chucky might tell me a story like Arthur Little died. And I don't want to sort of take up too much time, and it is a really sort of complex story that very much, I think, goes to the heart of who he was and why he was working with me. And also sort of touching on the sheer difficulty of trying to comprehend how it all came to an end.
Brilliant. This is a question for Mark in the first instance and then maybe for the whole panel. What myths do you think we need but don't have yet? You've got rid of a bunch of myths. Are there any replacement myths that we need?
I don't think that it's...
You're anti-myth anyway, right?
I don't know. It's a really good question, And I, right at the end of the book, I did start to wonder that. In part, I guess writing the book, and in fact studying history. So I did my doctorate maybe 10 years ago now. I started it, or 12 years ago. Took forever anyway. Has been a process of me losing confidence in what I believe to be true, and generally losing a degree of confidence even in the concept of objective truth. And I would never, ever have felt anything like that before. Now I think it is possible, although I do believe there is objective truth, there has to be. I do kind of think that if there are these myths that encourage people to believe in things that did not happen and therefore act in a way that is damaging, I think that there is, yes, now a possible argument for building counter myths. But I would never have said that before, and I'm not convinced. I'm open to the possibility for the first time.
Counter myths, I mean, can we sort of think about myth making as a way of sort of cultivating a practice of imagination for the world that we want to live in? I was really struck by the way you describe myths in your book as myths are sort of created and nurtured often from the simple desire that we want something to be true.
Yeah.
I'm just sort of thinking off the top of my head now, but, you know, can we create myths that paint a picture of a more just world?
Maybe that's what religion is. Maybe that's what ideas of the afterlife are, you know, a myth of ultimate justice, and maybe people need that to carry on, you know. I don't know.
A final question, I think, from the text messages is the kind of history that we're talking about, which is rigorous and transparent and fresh and edgy and engaging, is that the sort of history that's being taught, including in schools? Has our kind of new generation of historians, have you become the mainstream, and are you kind of hooking into curricula? Are you being taught?
Anna's created a podcast.
That's a really important question. Speaking of voice, we'll go back to... I wrote that book with the aim that it could be picked up by a high school history student, probably year 11 or 12, and who could comfortably read it and not feel like they were being talked down to, but could be brought into this complex conversation we call Australian history. Obviously, it depends vastly on where kids are going to school and the whether they're at high school or primary school. For example, high school teachers usually have a history degree and primary school teachers are great generalists. How much support history teachers or teachers generally have. I think there's a new national curriculum that's just been released which has deep time, Australian deep time, mandated for years 7 to 10, which is extraordinary considering when, you know, I was at school. But do the teachers have the support to teach it, the professional development to teach it well, to engage students in place-based learning, archives on country, all of those things? So we can have very aspirational curriculum documents, but they do require support and investment at the coalface where teachers are doing their work in order for them to be realised.
And you need to be training the next generation of historians who can come and can extend this practice and further develop practice as well.
I mean, I think it's a that question of history and history education in particular is critical, particularly in the wake of the Voice referendum. And, you know, regardless of where you sort of sat in that debate, I mean, the tenor of the debate and the conversation in the lead-up to it was really quite shocking, and I think a really sort of telling reflection of how deeply we need.
So generational too. If you think of when they're doing polls about young people, like I think of kids just very confidently and happily giving an acknowledgement of country as if it's something that one would do and think about, you know, the sort of ongoing human history of this place and how we might pay respects to sovereignty and ownership. That seemed very the vote itself seemed very generational, and young people overwhelmingly voted yes. And so it's kind of an interesting, you know, it's an interesting moment to think about how does this history play out in ripples generationally, and what people are taking on in school and elsewhere about their understandings and connections to Australian history.
But yeah, support for teachers is critical, as you touched on.
That's a fantastic point to land. Please join me in thanking the panellists.
You've been listening to Literary La Trobe, a La Trobe University podcast produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri country. To find out more, visit the La Trobe University website.